is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
She said the first accident occurred at 3 a.m. Sunday when a 70-seat bus from the western towns of Fumban and Bafusam crashed on the Nimale Bridge near the town of Makenene.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka from Yaoundé reporting on a deadly bus crash in Cameroon. Details coming up. Also, we get an update on Niger's as well as Central African Republic's Sunday elections. And Sudan deploys troops to South Darfur after a report of tribal violence. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The people of Niger are awaiting the results of Sunday's presidential and legislative elections. Voting appears to have been peaceful despite some challenges. For more, Chinedu Ofor spoke with VOA's House of Service reporter, Mahmoud Lalo.
This seems, it looks peaceful, it's orderly, everything is going on smoothly. What I'm seeing here are the election officials, delegates from different parties representing their various parties to make sure that everything is going on smoothly without any hitches. That is what is going on right now. And one funny thing, I don't know, they still, where they are counting the votes, they don't have lights, they are using their phone, the flashlight from their phones to count the votes. That's one bizarre thing that I noticed. There's no light in the place, but then people are still going on with the work and everything.
Have they given you any idea when the results will be out?
I spoke to an official of the CENI this morning. He told me that the election result will be out in the next 5 days. That's what the Niger electoral law says. But then immediately after releasing the results from now, maybe tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, they're going to hand over the results to the Constitutional Court, which will announce the final result officially. What they do in Niger, the process is as soon as all votes are collated and sent to CENI, CENI will count the vote and announce who won the election, but not to the public. They will say so-so person, candidate, so-so candidate won the election. They will then hand over the results to the Constitutional Court, which will look at the result and make sure that it tallies the way it's supposed to be before they finally announce what the official result will be.
Overall, how was the election? How would you rate this election?
I think I would give it 80 out of 100, Chinedu, because I must confess that everything went on smoothly. From opening the polls to the closing, there was no hitches, except that in some few places, there are pockets of late opening of the polls. But then at the end of the day, they were able to start the election and everything went on smoothly, no any hitches. I've noticed a lot of security men stationed in various polling units just to ensure that everything goes on smoothly. Overall, I would say it was a peaceful election in Chinedu.
That was VOA House of Service reporter Mahmoud Lalo speaking with my colleague Chinedu Ofor. Despite rebels opening fire in some areas to try to scare away voters, Central African Republic residents turned out in large numbers yesterday for presidential and legislative elections. According to a Reuters report, rebels hostile to President Faustin Archange Touadéra, who is seeking a second term, carried out attacks and threatened to march to the capital and disrupt the election after the Constitutional Court rejected several candidates, including former President François Bozizé. Bozizé's candidacy was rejected because he faces an arrest warrant and UN sanctions for allegedly ordering killings and torture during his presidency. He denies the charges. Russia and Rwanda have dispatched military personnel to help the beleaguered government. Local and Rwandan soldiers were patrolling the streets of the capital yesterday. Touadéra is considered the favorite in the field of 17 presidential candidates. Results are expected by the end of the week. The election will go to a second round if no candidate receives more than 50% of the vote. Scores of Cameroonians have been visiting mortuaries to identify and collect the bodies of relatives who perished in two bus crashes Sunday that left 39 people dead between the capital Yaoundé and the western commercial city of Bafoussam. The Central African State's president, Paul Biya, has ordered immediate investigations into the cause of the accident, which has also left 19 people in critical condition. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Flavien Awano, a social worker in the western commercial town of Bafoussam, says he has been in search of his two children since he was informed of Sunday's accident. He says a phone call from the police informed him that his son and daughter were involved in a deadly accident in Nemele village in the Likinimiki administrative unit. Awanu says after a fruitless search at Likinimiki and Makenene hospitals, he has come to Yaoundé to find out if his children are in any hospitals or their bodies are in any mortuary. Awanu says his children were returning from Bafoussam, where they had spent Christmas with him, to celebrate the change from 2020 to 2021 with their mother in the capital Yaoundé. Paul Atanganji, Cameroon Minister of Territorial Administration, who was sent to the scene by President Paul Biya, described what he found. Nji said the first accident occurred at 3 a.m. Sunday when a 70-seat bus from the western towns of Fumban and Bafoussam crashed on the Nemale Bridge near the town of Makenene. The bus landed in a 30-meter deep dry riverbed. The second occurred when another bus hit civilians and rescue workers who were helping victims of the first accident.
Two accidents occurred in the same place. We have come here to extend the heartfelt condolences of President Paul Biya to the bereaved families and also the wish of the head of state that the wounded should be treated quickly. We'll have a report which will be sent to the head of state and to the prime minister, head of government, so that we can have further instructions.
Cameroon Transport Minister Jean-Ernest Messina Ngalé-Bibéhé was also sent to the scene by Biya. He says the government has ordered investigations on the causes of the accident. Bibéhé says it was a Black Sunday in Cameroon, as so many lives were lost in less than 24 hours. He says the government took all necessary measures to avoid road accidents during this end-of-year period when many people are traveling by warning drivers against excessive speed. He says, unfortunately, some drivers disrespect the driving code, especially on roads where there are no police officers who can charge the drivers for misconduct. He says road users should respect driving norms and stop the many accidents and deaths that occur each year in Cameroon. During the past 10 years, Cameroon has reported an average of more than 16,000 road accidents, killing close to 2,000 people each year. The government blames the over-importation of second-hand cars, mechanical failure, the use of old and worn tires, hazardous overtaking, excessive speed, and the bad state of roads. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Sudan deployed troops to South Darfur after a report of a tribal violence that killed 15 people. The state is part of the Darfur region, which suffered a bitter conflict that erupted in 2003. The United Nations estimates the fighting killed 300,000 people and displaced 2.5 million. Reuters reports the latest violence started over a dispute over a water source between members of two tribes, the Masalit and the Falata. Two people from the Falata tribe were killed. Falata members responded by killing 13 people from the Masalat and wounding 34 others. The area has witnessed several bloody clashes between the tribes over the past 2 years. It comes less than a week after the UN Security Council agreed to end the UN and Africa Union's long-running peacekeeping mission in Darfur when its mandate expires December 31st. The termination was requested by the Sudanese government and backed by China, Russia, and African members of the Security Council. Turkish Defense Minister warned that any attack on Turkish forces in Libya by the Libyan National Army would make General Khalifa Haftar's forces a legitimate target. Haftar has said his army would prepare to drive out the occupier, referring to Turkish troops backing the government of National Accord in Tripoli. And a senior Egyptian delegation arrived in Tripoli on Sunday, the first visit by an official delegation to Tripoli since 2014. News reports say the delegation has several missions, among which is to ease tension between East and West. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Parshtay, former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
The recent visit of Turkish Minister of Defense Hulusi Akar not only served to deepen the bilateral relationship between Ankara and Tripoli, Turkey and Libya in general, but especially to strengthen significantly the Muslim Brotherhood and Misrata faction in the government of National Accord towards their internal rivals, Serraj, Maitig, and the Tripoli militias. But a key element of the discussion was also about the future strategy against the Libyan National Army. The clear aim remains to get the whole of Libya under control, preferably by political means, but also, if necessary, by military means. Hulusi Akar's statement threatening to attack the Libyan National Army headquarters and Haftar in person is a clear and credible warning. Such a Turkish strike on Al-Rajma is possible almost any time with fighter planes from Turkey or with land attack missiles from ships. There is not much the Libyan National Army could do about it. But Egypt would certainly detect the strike package on its way from Turkey and could intercept it on the way back home. A major Libyan National Army offensive is currently unlikely anyway, as they are clearly inferior to the combined forces of Turkey in Libya and Operation Volcano. But smaller attacks by renegade militias can certainly happen almost any time. And Akar's statement should certainly serve to prevent some kind of small-scale raids or guerrilla attacks on Turkish forces.
A senior Egyptian delegation arrived in Tripoli on Sunday, marking the first visit by an official delegation to Tripoli since 2014. News reports say the delegation has several missions, among which is to ease the tension between East and West. What's your take on that?
This was certainly a very remarkable visit. The delegation was led by Ayman Badi, a deputy director of the General Intelligence Directorate, and included also some senior diplomats from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Badi was recently together with his boss, the director of the General Intelligence Directorate, in Al-Rajma for talks with LNA commander Khalifa Haftar. So the visit was certainly coordinated with Haftar, but I doubt that Haftar is pleased about it. On the other side, there was no way for him to block it. The main topic of the visit was the normalization of diplomatic relations and the reopening of the Egyptian embassy in Tripoli. Egyptian delegation had very high-ranking meetings. They met with Deputy Prime Minister Maitig, with the Minister of the Interior Bashagha, and Foreign Minister Siala, so quite high-ranking counterparts. The Egyptians certainly delivered also a political message to the GNA, namely that Egypt accepts the current situation in Libya with the GNA in charge, but with a security zone denying Islamist militias and terrorist groups to use the east of Libya to stage attacks on Egypt. Such an acceptance is not really surprising, as this is certainly sufficient to safeguard Egyptian vital security interests. So Cairo is interested in a certain normalization of the relations with the GNA. This is also in the interest of the many Egyptians who work in Libya. But at the same time, they made clear that al-Sisi's red line west of Sirte is still valid. And allegedly, they demanded also the withdrawal of Turkish forces from Libya.
On the 69th anniversary of Libya's independence, the UN mission in Libya highlighted the importance of building on the positive progress achieved in the multi-track talks and implementing the comprehensive ceasefire agreement and building a unified state. How feasible is that?
Unfortunately, this Libyan political dialogue forum is more or less dead right now. Although acting UN Special Representative Stephanie Williams got never ever tired from claiming historic successes after almost any of the meetings, there were none. A date of elections, as it is now the 24th of December next year, is not a major success in itself, as long as everything else, from the administrative division to the electoral law and the constitution, is unclear. There was not even an agreement on how to select a new presidential council and the prime minister. The military track, the so-called 5+5 talks, are also stuck. Nothing is implemented but the ceasefire itself and the prisoner of war exchange. But let me underline, the ceasefire itself is already a remarkable progress. The economic track is still in a very early phase, so it's too early to say if there will be an outcome, a unification, reunification of the Eastern and Western economic entities. So to conclude, a new UN special representative would be urgently needed. And with him, it would be necessary to launch an entirely new approach for the stabilization of Libya.
That was Wolfgang Parshtay, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking to my colleague Mohammed Al-Shinhawi. The South African government says it is disappointed by a perception created by its counterpart in the United Kingdom that a COVID variant identified in South Africa is driving infections in Britain. British scientists themselves say the UK's current wave of infection is, in fact, being partly caused by a new coronavirus lineage found there as early as September. Scientists from across the world say there is no evidence that the South African variant is any more or less dangerous than Britain's. Darren Taylor reports.
Last week, the UK confirmed two cases of the mutation recently identified in South Africa in residents who had returned from the country. This prompted Britain's Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, to brief the media in London.
This new variant is highly concerning because it is yet more transmissible and it appears to have mutated further than the new variant that's been discovered in the UK.
Scientists say this statement contains two inaccuracies. Firstly, there's no evidence that South Africa's COVID-19 variant is more transmissible or more infectious than the UK's. Secondly, there's no evidence that the South African type has mutated further, as Hancock put it. One of Britain's leading virus experts, Professor Neil Ferguson, has told a parliamentary committee it's the UK variant that's likely spread further afield, not South Africa's.
The fact they picked up 10 cases of this new variant in a country as small as Denmark with a relatively low infection rate would suggest, almost certainly in my view, that this virus has been introduced into the great majority, if not all, of European countries at the current time.
Ferguson, an epidemiologist, also says he's concerned about the rhetoric that the South African variant may cause more serious illness and even death. He says there's no evidence of this. Nevertheless, the UK government has banned flights from South Africa. That's pretty pointless, says Dr. Richard Lessels, a specialist in genetic sequencing and one of the scientists who identified the South African variant in a laboratory in Durban.
What we saw at the beginning of the epidemic in many parts of the world was these travel bans actually had limited impact because there was already more spread than you were detecting. And that's likely to be the case here, that there's probably already been more spread than we know about at the moment. We won't be surprised if in the next couple of weeks or so we start detecting the UK variant here in South Africa.
Lessel says there's no need to play a blame game. Virus mutations are common and are likely all over the world right now. It's just that they haven't been identified yet.
Part of the reason for this is that South Africa and the UK have amongst the strongest genomic surveillance systems in the world. So we're doing this systematic tracking of the virus, regularly sequencing the virus from different parts of the country to see how it's evolving over time.
He adds that most countries do limited or no sequencing of viruses.
That makes it very challenging to understand the spread, the dissemination of these new variants. Really, the finding both here in South Africa and the UK is really highlighting how important this genomic surveillance is to inform the public health response around the world.
South Africa's Health Minister Zweli Mkhize responded to his British counterpart's incorrect assertions with a calm and measured statement, which said they were concerning. But South African government sources have told VOA that both Mkhize and President Cyril Ramaphosa are angered by Hancock's comments, describing them as irresponsible, with the potential to fuel discrimination against South Africans residing in Britain. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In South Africa, hospitals once again are struggling to find beds for people who are seriously ill with COVID-19 as the country grapples with a new surge in cases. Earlier this year, the first wave of the pandemic, as hospitals were struggling to cope with cases, Darren Taylor brought us the story of one family affected by the disease. We are rerunning that series, and in this segment, we learn about the conditions for patients in a COVID-19 intensive care unit, or ICU, at a hospital in Cape Town, South Africa's coronavirus epicenter.
Fazila Abrahams's 61-year-old sister, Yasmin Hafaji, is in a hospital with COVID-19. Hafaji, speaking through Abrahams, says she feels terrified, powerless, and alone.
Nobody wants to be there. Not the nurses, not the patients, not the doctors. Nobody wants to be in that ICU.
Hafaji has told Abrahams she thinks some of the nurses don't have the skills to care for patients who are critically ill with coronavirus.
She says the nurses told her we were not trained. We were not trained, we were thrown into this.
The hospital has confirmed it's so overwhelmed that it's using some nurses in the ICU who don't have the experience of such a specialized environment. Hafaji says hours sometimes pass without patients seeing any medical staff.
The nurses are scared. The doctors are scared because of the unknown. I think they're scared of being there. And so they decrease the amount of contact that they have with the patient.
According to Hafaji, she sometimes doesn't eat because porters refuse to deliver food to the coronavirus unit. The hospital denies this is happening. Abrahams, a medical researcher and former nurse herself, knows how stressful it is to work inside a hospital unit that's treating people with highly infectious diseases. As frightening as COVID-19 is, she says nurses and doctors have a duty to treat patients with a care and respect they deserve.
My sister told me many accounts of how she felt totally being not treated as a human, being ignored, totally ignored. Nurses are scared to come near you. And they come near you just to check the machines. And you must ask 10 times for a bedpan. And so you wet yourself, and then they are angry also.
Abraham says the nurses appear to be paranoid about just two aspects of treating coronavirus patients.
It's the mask on the face, the CPAP, and the A-line. The A-line, I know, is a dangerous thing. It's an arterial line near the clavicle, and it is where they draw blood from daily to check your progress.
She says nurses have to pay close attention to an A-line because a patient can bleed to death if it malfunctions. But their obsession, as she puts it, comes at a cost.
The humanness is taken out of caring now because it's not a human you're taking care of. You're taking care of a mask and an A-line. But that's what they're trained to do. They're scared, my sister says.
She says from what her sister tells her, COVID ICU is similar to a labor ward.
When women are in that period when they must deliver the baby and they are powerless, and we as the nurses tell them, you need to push, and if you don't do this, you're going to kill your child. If you don't do what we tell you, you're going to die.
Hafaji says she'll never forget the people who've died around her over the past month, and she prays she's remembered as someone who survived the COVID-19 plague, as she calls it. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.